Got Big Waz on the show today, and we're handing out NBA offseason grades. That's coming up right now. All right, welcome back. Let's talk some NBA with Big Waz, Wazzy Lambre. Waz, how you doing today, man?
I'm doing fantastic, man. Happy to be on with you guys today.
Let's do some off-season grades right now, because I want to go through big overview, stuff that's happened this summer, what it could mean for the season ahead. Let's start out with three different categories. We're going to do the Eastern Conference, Western Conference, and the Euros. Right now, with Euro basket happening right now, figure it's a good time to start off with some of the players in that competition right now. So I want to start off with Luka. Luka's weight loss journey was, what kind of grade would you give this? A, B, C, D, F. What's the grade so far for Luka's weight loss journey?
I mean, I'm going to give it a solid B plus. It's not just the weight, like, because losing weight is one thing, but it has to be functional, right? Like, are you quicker? Are you, you know, more fresh? Are you putting less pressure on your body in terms of your joints and your muscles? And your lower extremities? Like, that's what the weight loss is for. It's not just this cosmetic thing or just this idea he's quote unquote taking care of his body. It's like what it actually means for his performance. And I think he does look, you know, quicker than he was, albeit I don't know that he's back to being sort of the 2021 version of himself, but I think, you know, you can't say that it's anything but good. It's just, for me, my problem with Luka in the more recent past, in terms of his performance in the finals against Boston or even the previous playoff performance, is that he just felt like, you know, he's not the guy that was constantly beating guys off the dribble and kind of getting them on his hip and then using his strength that way and just being a master of angles and, you know, leveraging his body against defenders. It's been more of a not dribbling by guys and settling for the step back. And so I was hoping that the weight loss would bring some of that, you know, more quicker on the ball juice that we saw previously in Luka Doncic's career. And I think some of that is back, to be sure. I just don't know that it's all the way back to the degree that I would have hoped. You know, when you think about, remember the first time he played against Kawhi and Paul George in the playoffs, and those guys couldn't do anything with him. And it's not because he was doing a bunch of step backs. It's because literally he was just breaking these guys down in their primes, damn near, as defenders off the dribble. And I'd like to see a little bit of that come back to Luka's game.
Yeah, I think with Luka, I mean, the defense as well, of course. I mean, that's been talked about over and over again, I mean, with the flaws on that end of the floor. But it is interesting, like, when you look at the shooting frequency numbers for Luka early in his career, the first 2 years of his career, 29% and 33% of his shots came at the rim. Last season, that was down to 15%. The year before, that was 18%. And so taking more mid-range, taking a bit more three-pointers as well, to your point about settling for some of the jumpers. And I think with Luka, obviously, he's still a dominant player. He's also become a better three-point shooter, more efficient on those shots later in his career. So it's more forgivable when he's taking those. But to your point, getting to the basket, those are the highest efficiency shots in basketball. So if he's able to get even more of those, he could be even better. To me, like, I think a B-plus is a perfectly fair grade for what we've seen so far this offseason. Before he had it doesn't seem like the knee contusion he had is any issue. He practiced on Monday. He's supposed to play on Tuesday for Slovenia. He had 26-5-5 in the first half before he got knocked out. He did look nimble. He looks quick. That's what we want. and to me, it's about how do you sustain it over the course of the long season. That's, to me, the big question.
So, and this is, it's that part. And I think there's just a lack of appreciation, I think, for balance. Like, we understand that we live in the three-point revolution, but, and I was talking to a mutual friend of ours about this, you know, when the Celtics went down against the Knicks. Yes, if you believe that three-point shooting is good, like the Celtics are like the paragon of, like, this is what wins modern basketball, blah, blah, blah. I don't think that has to be untrue in order to also feel like they just played a very unbalanced style of basketball. Like, it was just straight up too predictable that these guys were going to just fire off the very first available three, even while up 18, and against a team that they're clearly better than, right? And I think on a team level, you see how that could, you know, sort of mess up your results in terms of success. But on an individual level, I think it's the same thing. Like, the hardest things to defend are those that are unpredictable. And if Luka Doncic can become more diversified in his tack, thereby being more unpredictable, making defenses more unbalanced, and like, oh, shoot, what do we do? Like, is this guy going to bully us and take us to the rack? Is, you know, is he going to pop up for that famous step back? Like, he has a variety of things he can attack the defense with. And I think that's why it's important. It's not just like we want to be get off our lawn guys, KOC, and be like, stop with the jump shots. Like, it's not that. It's like you need to be well balanced in order to be most effective.
Sure. And I think with him, of course, he's been an excellent playoff performer, but sustaining it over the full duration of the playoffs at the highest levels in the finals, having diversity on offense matters. And obviously, you know, being able to survive on defense matters a lot too. Lauri Markkanen, so far for Finland, he has games scoring 48, 42, and 31 points so far in Eurobasket competition. Give me a grade, Waz, for Utah's decision to keep Lauri Markkanen amidst everything else they've done this offseason, losing a lot of veterans, bringing in some younger guys. They look like they're tanking, but they're keeping Lauri Markkanen. Give me a grade for that decision from the Jazz perspective.
I mean, I don't even want to cop out because I think it is a B decision in terms of, I guess it's easy for somebody sitting on their couch who doesn't have to sell a product to a fan base in terms of getting people to pay their money, getting people to pay with their eyeballs on television, to be like, oh, tear this thing down to the studs. You don't need useful players if you're ushering in a youth movement. At the same time, this guy is a great player. Like the idea that you wouldn't want this guy next to your young guys who you're trying to rebuild around, I'm actually a believer that this should be a base level of competency even as you're rebuilding. This idea that you hand out, you know, playing time to young guys as if it's like candy at Halloween, KOC, where it's just like everybody gets to play. No, you should have to earn your playing time. And the only way to actually do that is to surround the young guys with competence, thereby making them have to compete for their playing time. And I think keeping Lauri Markkanen around is justifiable for that alone. Like, I don't know why a bunch of young guys should have to come into a situation where there's no culture, no professionalism, nobody who's competent, nobody who's pushing them. And they're just sort of handed the keys to the franchise. And it's sort of like, just keep failing and nobody will ever care. There'll be no accountability. Now, do I think you need to do a Mike Malone and basically like be at open war with your GM and don't play any young guys ever? No, I don't think you should do that either. But I think that, again, there needs to be some level of give and take when it comes to the rebuilding. And I think Lauri Markkanen, especially because he's not this like ball dominant guy, he's a fucking elevator. He's going to elevate everything around a dude who is more ball dominant because he's so effective in his shooting and his cutting. And, you know, he could take advantage of mismatches. And he's just such a smart player, plays his ass off. I'm not mad at the Jazz for not being like, yo, let's just get rid of every single competent player we've ever had so we could fully usher in the youth movement. Now, the way that they were doing it before, where they were getting too cute about their quote unquote assets and making, you know, good the perfect, the enemy of perfect, and trying to execute the perfect trade on every single guy on their roster, I thought that was a mistake too. And I think they probably stayed better than they should have, longer than they should have. But Lauri, I think, should be on this team, man. Like, if they don't get a package that blows them away, because he can be a part of making their future brighter.
I think those 3 points are all spot on, Waz. I'd go even further. I'd give it an A+ to keep Lauri.
I love that.
And the reason being is everything you said about the youth aspect, like, you have some stability, you have some vets mixed in there. It creates a better culture for development for the long term, for your future, for guys like Ace Bailey and Walter Clayton, these rookies coming in, helping them come along. But also, the fact is he came off a not so good season, injury riddled, production was down, efficiency was down. So if you're the Jazz, you're telling me after holding him in such high regard, unwilling to trade him last summer after one of the best seasons of his career, then you're going to sell low? I don't think so. I think you get a bank on Lowry having a bounce back year, and maybe he's so great that either you are like, you know what? We'll keep him, and he can be part of our future too. Or another team is like, we have to have Lowry Markkanen in order to have a chance to win the NBA Finals, and a team goes over the top, 4 or 5 first-round draft picks, young guy, whatever it is, because they perceive Lowry as the missing piece for their title chances. So for the Jazz, to me, like, this is by far the best thing they could have done this summer. And obviously, it's just, you know, August basketball right now, but 48 points, 42 points, 31 points. He looks
this
like
this is a high level of competition. Yes, I don't think it's something that you can just poo-poo. Like, I think, like, you can be sort of dismissive of the Euros if you want, but these are high level,
exactly,
professional players, like highly competitive environments. These guys, like, these dudes take this stuff deadly serious in terms of playing for their national teams. And so in that level of competition, for him to be playing the way that he is, I think it's a great thing. I don't think this is something you can just brush off as insignificant.
I totally agree with you. And I think it'll be exciting to see how Ace Bailey develops in the situation next to Lowry in that front court. So I think the Utah is going to be fun to watch. Like, one of those, like, bad teams that are fun to watch in the Western Conference. Moving out east, Giannis Antetokounmpo so far seems like he's going to be staying in Milwaukee. Give me a grade for Giannis deciding to stay true and loyal to Milwaukee.
F+.
F+.
What's lower than an F? F-.
You flunk out of school?
It's the Giannis thing. I just don't like the whole have my cake and eat it too element to this, where it's like, oh, I don't want to be shadow GM. I don't want to be, like, involved in decisions. But clearly, when you see how desperate the Bucks are moving, they're doing it at the behest of Giannis and what they perceive to be the things that are going to make him happy. You know, stretching Damian Lillard so you can sign Miles Turner. Like, that is – there's no other way to put it but that being a desperation move. And you don't do something that desperate without the – tacit and implicit approval of the most important player in the history of the franchise, right? And that being said, it's like, if you're so thirsty to win, this Bucks team ain't it. You know, so this idea that the only thing he cares about is winning, while also just being like, I'm going to stay and be around this particular grouping of the Bucks, and also, you know, leaking it through several media people like, oh, Giannis hasn't completely made up his mind. It's like, bro, like, just get off the pot, bro. Like, at a certain point, are you gonna stay or are you gonna go? Like, I'm kind of over the way Giannis is doing this, like, oh, I'm not happy, oh, I might get a trade, oh, it's like, just make a decision. The team would get a great haul for you. Just be a man and just be like, yo, I've given all I've got could to this franchise. We're not in a position to compete for championships. I'm a guy that really cares about winning championships, and I want to go pursue that somewhere else. I don't see anything wrong with that.
So I think with Giannis, one of the things you said that I disagree with a little bit is you said this roster's not it. I think in the East, though, the East is weak. It's the
KOC,
East isn't.
Don't do this.
If you're Giannis. You're going to look at your situation and feel like, okay, the Eastern Conference is open. With me, if I'm speaking, if I'm Giannis, with me on the team, no, I can have an MVP caliber season. No, we're going to play at a faster pace, ball in my hands. I'm going to put up a triple-double, Jokic numbers. I'm going to be point Giannis this year with Turner at the five instead of old man Brook Lopez. We brought back the good pieces from last year. We added a shooter in Gary Harris. We added a smart plug guard in Cole Anthony.
Oh, God.
Well, I mean, look, I'm just saying, if you're Giannis, you got to be looking at the situation feeling like, hey, if things are tweaked a little bit, we got a chance to make a run if we stay healthy. And so I know the names on paper are nothing special. When you're talking about Gary Harris and Kevin Porter Jr. and Taurean Prince and Kyle Kuzma and AJ Green, but when you have Giannis Antetokounmpo, to me, the big I get for what it's worth, I'm going to give him a C+ for the decision, because I think giving it a little bit of time is understandable. But to me, the big question isn't the roster, was as much as the question is, what is Doc Rivers actually going to do with the system? And what's Giannis going to be willing to do? Is Giannis going to be willing to be point Giannis? Is Doc going to let this team play fast, up and down, switchable on defense, playing a modernized style? Or is it going to be like the same one-dimensional, boring offense? Is that what it's going to be? Where it's very, talk about predictable.
Wait, what do you think a Giannis-centric, Giannis 40% usage offense is going to be? You think it's going to be like dynamic and unpredictable? Like, you know, here's the thing.
Let me answer that, Waz. I think the way it could be is, you look at what they did in April. Giannis averages a triple-double that month. They're putting the ball in his hands.
April basketball? That's what we're talking about?
Yes, we're talking about April basketball.
Where half the league is not playing any of their guys?
Exactly.
Okay. Continue.
April basketball. It was point Giannis time. Okay. And with that, with guys like Porter and Rollins and Green and Trent, like a bunch of like Andre Jackson types, fast moving up and down style. If they play with tempo, now with Miles Turner taking him from the Pacers, he can do some of that tempo stuff more so than Brook Lopez ever could. I think it could be a fast paced, fun team with some motion and movement and ball movement. I just don't know if Giannis can play that way, because we didn't really see him adapt with Dame over the last handful of years.
We know he can't play that way. This is the thing. Like I have a long memory with Giannis, because I was kind of side-eyeing this dude before everybody else, because we got to remember why the Dame trade was made. The idea that Giannis would be your sort of only dynamism on the ball could result in quality postseason offense was obliterated. Like, we knew that was not the path to success for the Bucks, and so they did this all-in deal for Dame Lillard to try to accomplish a new way of imagining a Giannis-centric still offense. So my thing is, like, what you're talking about is what they used to do in the playoffs before Dame Lillard. And everybody agreed that wasn't good enough. By the way, it was backstopped by one of the most dominant defenses in the NBA at the time. So this whole Giannis dribble, 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 fake perimeter star Giannis, which he's never been, by the way. He's always been one of our most dominant finishers in the history of the game. He's never been an elite on-ball initiator. Yes, he can do things in transition on the ball, one of the greatest transition finishers ever. He's never been a give him the ball 30 feet from the basket and let this guy operate and cook and generate great offense. That's never been something Giannis was elite at. Now that he's 30, I'm supposed to believe like he's even better at it. I don't see that. And again, if you have one of the, like, the sort of blueprint for this, because you know you're not going to generate like a, you know, like Denver Nuggets at its peak level offense, right? We know that's not going to be the case with a Giannis-backed, Giannis-centric, Giannis-everything offense. We know it ain't going to be pretty. We know it's barely going to be competent. If that, it needs to be backstopped by one of the league's best defensive units. Do you see one of the league's best defensive units on this roster?
Probably not.
Personnel-wise?
Probably not.
Why I'm like, if you're not going to have, we know, like, they're not going to generate elite offense with this. It's not going to happen, KOC.
But what about the fact that
defense is not
going to
be top five?
But what about the fact they're in the East?
They're not, like, this is the thing. I think we got to get out of this superstar driven era that we all grew up in, where it could be Shaq and Kobe and Devin George, or it could be Mike and Scotty and you know, Judd Bushler and Randy
Steve
Brown
Kerr.
And Steve Kerr. Like, your roster needs to be more well-rounded, even when you have the best of players on your team. Like, just look at OKC. Look at Denver. Like, even Denver, when it's having its shortcomings, it's like, man, like, Jokic is one of the greatest players we've ever seen. They still need, like, six or seven competent guys to give them rotation minutes. They need 7 to 8 realistically. Even when you got Jokic, even when it's Jamal Murray, even when you have all of this stuff in your favor, you know, even the Knicks, They go to the conference finals. It's like, you know, they're still giving campaign some minutes. That's going to hurt them in a playoff series. This, like, you need to, you can have a superstar. You need to have 7 or 8 complementary and capable rotation players with that superstar. Like, it's just not good enough to have individual greatness on your team. Like, and so, like, this idea that, like, I'm supposed to look at the Bucks as better than Detroit, I don't think so. I think Detroit just has way more evenly dispersed talent throughout their rotation. And Detroit's going to be better. Orlando's going to be better. We know the Knicks are going to be way better than them. Obviously, Cleveland is going to be way better. Those are 4 teams right there that I think are cut above these guys. And that's before we consider a Giannis injury for 6 weeks or anything like that. Like, I'm not seeing this Bucks. I can grant you that Giannis might have an individually brilliant season where he plays amazing. I'm not saying that's not possible. I'm just saying in today's NBA, it's not good enough. Like, I think about the ultimate example of this, which is 2009-2010 LeBron taking Cleveland like 63-66 wins with the likes of Andy Varejao and Sasha Booby Gibson and Sasha Pavlovich and you know Delonte West in the Western Conference Finals against the Magic, where they lost to Dwight Howard and Hedo Turkoglu and all of those guys. He was the second best player on that Cleveland Cavaliers team. They went to the conference finals, guys. Like, that kind of can't happen in today's NBA. Like, it's just the league is just too talented for you, even one of the all-time greatest players. And I would submit that LeBron in 2009, when you combine his skill with his raw athleticism, like, this is one of the, like, 2 or 3 greatest NBA players we've ever seen. And yeah, you get 66 wins back then. You could even get to a conference finals. Giannis could play like peak Jordan next season. This team is not winning 50 games. Like, I swear to God, like, they're just not good enough, KO. What is going to be their calling card on either side of the ball? Like, they're going to be like a stop, like, they're going to stop you defensively? Because we know Miles Turner is now a better offensive player than he is defensive player. Where early in his career, it was kind of reversed. He was like this elite big guy who could switch, who was a great rim protector, he's still a good defender, but he's not an anchoring defender anymore. And I love Kuzma, but I think he got poisoned, man, by being on such teams for, you know, basically 5 years after the Lakers got rid of him. Like, he's developed just horrible habits. And it's just like Kevin Porter Jr. is going to be prominently involved in this. And like Cole Anthony, shouts to him, Malloy, Art Bishop Malloy product, CHSAA product. Love the guy. This is the foundation of quality. What exactly, KOC? I'm not seeing it. Sorry, Bucks fans.
I think the argument is simply the East sucks. You have Giannis. You win 47 games, and you know you get in and you get a chance.
47 games is a lot.
But to your point, I think everything you said about the quality of depth is true. I mean, we saw it with Boston 2 years ago. We saw it with OKC this year. Like, we saw it with Indiana going to the finals and they lose. Like, having depth is so critical.
It's so big.
Yes, it's so important. And that's where I think this year, Giannis, if it doesn't go well, if you're right, Waz, if everything you're saying pans out to be true, that will be the lesson that I think Giannis learns this year, where it's like, well, you know what? What do we do now? Like, there's literally nothing. They already did the desperate move, getting rid of Dame and adding Miles Turner. It was a creative move. Got to give John Horst and that Bucks front office credit. But the reason why they're in this position where they got to take those risks is because Horst missed in the draft time and time and time and time again. That's why they don't have depth. That's why they're being desperate. And that's why Giannis is in this position where he's not necessarily committing for the future entirely at this state of time. Right now, it seems like he's just focusing on international stuff.
How many games did the Lakers win last year?
Let's fact check this real quick.
Pull that up.
The Lakers won 50 games last year, the 3 seed.
50 games last year.
Yep. 50.
With the combined production of Luka Doncic, LeBron James, and Anthony Davis. That was a 50-win team.
Well, there's also the West. The West is a lot more tough to get
to. So what, you think they would have won 54 games in the East?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, for sure.
Okay.
I mean, last year, Cleveland wins 64, Boston wins 61, New York wins 51, Indiana wins 50. I think they
definitely The Knicks last year won 51 games, KOC. You telling me this Bucks team is only 4 games worse than last year's Knicks?
The Bucks won 48 last year.
Again, Damian Lillard and Giannis Antetokounmpo's combined production. Now...
We'll see. We'll see, Waz. Maybe I'm just more bullish on what Giannis can be.
This will be a fun thing to monitor. I know. We'll be in contact about this all season long.
I know. We'll see what happens there. What did you think about him slapping his teammate on the back of the head, that viral?
Weird. Weird.
Well, you never did that to your friends in high school?
No? I've never done that in my life. No, nobody's ever done that to me.
Really? No.
Weird.
Is a thing
European with, culture, I guess. I don't know.
It's a thing with my friends.
The Greeks.
High school.
Super handsy.
Coincidentally, with my Haitian friends, it's a thing in high school.
Bro, he hit that dude really hard.
Really hard. It was never that hard in high school.
Like, come on, bro.
It was a light tap in high school. That was like a open-handed slap punch.
Almost. Greek listeners of the KOC show, reach out to us and let us know if that's normal in your culture.
Yes, please let us know. And we'll be right back after this break. All right, let's move on to the Eastern Conference, Waz. Miles Turner, I want to start out with him because we just talked about the Bucks. Give me a grade for Miles Turner's decision to leave Indiana for Milwaukee.
I mean, you know, like... I was so happy for him to get a chance to go to the finals and be so instrumental in the run because, and it's been said, like the guy's been on the trade block for 5-6 years, every single year.
Every year.
Every single year, this guy's been in trade rumors and he's done, I just think the world of the guy and his game and how he's developed as a player. Like, I'm one of the biggest Miles Turner fans out there. At the same time, like, you need to be financially remunerated. And if the team is just like, look, Halliburton's gone for the year, we're not going to be competitive. Like, to me, I don't see how they wouldn't have been the Eastern Conference favorites to go to the finals again next year if they brought everybody back. They were that damn good in the postseason. That damn good, not just the postseason, and it does bear mentioning, from January of this year, they were one of the best 4 or 5 best teams in the entire NBA. And then in the playoffs, they just continued to show that level of class and form. And so for the team to be like, look, Hallie's gone for a year. It just happens to be that you're up for a deal. We're going to do something different in terms of just being, you know, a bit more frugal and be realistic about what we can accomplish and what we should be willing to pay to accomplish what is obviously below the standard that they've set with Halliburton this past playoffs. I think it's fair for both teams, both parties to be like, look, I'm not taking a haircut. I've given you guys so much. I help you guys get to the finals. And Indy's saying, look, you know, we're not going to do anything next year. I don't see why we should be expensive to do so. So respect to both teams. I'm glad they facilitated that move for him. I'm happy he got paid. I don't think there's many guys that deserve it more than Miles Turner. And so I give him an A+, man. Get your money.
Yeah, I think so too. You know, give him an A+. Tough decision, I'm sure, to leave Indiana. But for him, you come so close to a title, and now it's going to be a year in which there's no title chance. You go to a situation where you get your money, you get paid, take care of your family, and even though we disagree in the Bucks' chances, you feel like you give yourself a chance to still win.
Yeah, he's still on a competitive team. It's not like he went to Sacramento or anything stupid like that. He's still on a team that can do something relevant. And, you know, the only thing I will say, too, I think I would have been very interested in watching the Pacers run this entire thing back without Hallie because I just think the world of these other guys.
Me too.
Nemhard, you know, when it comes to Nemhard,
Mathurin,
Nesmith, I mean, it's crazy. You know, McConnell, like... Siak, like, I just think the world of these other dudes and what they were able to, like, the thing is, like, they just kept doing it, KOC. Like, these guys just kept being nails in big spots. And not just like, oh, the scrappy stuff, like being great on ball guys, being great defenders, rebounders, full court pressers. Like, bro, like I would have loved to try to watch them try to piece together a competitive outfit. Almost like if you remember, you know, Toronto the year right after Kawhi left, where people were like, oh, Kawhi's gone, they're not going to be that good. And they were just a hyper-competitive bunch. And, you know, played their asses off in the regular season and in the playoffs. Gave Jason Tatum, oh my God, he's still having nightmares about that series against OG Anunoby and all of those guys. I would have loved to see them kind of have a bounce back type of year, but you know, I think Pritchard and them, those guys have earned the benefit of the doubt in terms of roster construction and how well they know their team and their guys and how they're gonna respond. So, you know, I trust that they're doing something smart here.
The Knicks fired Tibbs, hired Mike Brown, added Gershon Yabusele and Jordan Clarkson. Mm-hmm. Give me a grade for the moves. Knicks offseason.
I give it a B.
Only a B?
I give it a B.
What's holding it back from being higher than that?
Only reason I give it a B is because I just don't know if Mike Brown has the gravitas that these guys are going to actually allow him to coach. What do I mean by that? The Knicks played this very deliberate, unimaginative style of offensive basketball. You know, Jalen Brunson, like a 50% usage in clutch time. Karl Towns can't even find the ball. They're paying him damn near $60 million a year to turn him into a freaking glorified screen setter and floor spacer, you know, in the biggest moments of games. Just, again, just the theme of this pod has been predictability. And, you know, some people would say methodical if they're being charitable. I would say it's just too predictable and not dynamic enough. They know, I think internally they knew that in order to take another step, they had to become a more varied and diverse offensive attack, right? And the way that you're paying the guys around Brunson, they should have more responsibility and more ownership of what the Knicks do on offense. Also, Mike Brown's offense in Sacramento was legitimately a well-run, very smart, way more egalitarian type of offense that you could tell was very influenced by Steve Kerr and his time with the Warriors. Like, the Sacramento Kings had a really nice offense that they run. Mike Brown wasn't always associated with great offenses. He was a defense first guy, and his offenses were, I don't know, I just let LeBron figure it out. That's what he was associated with early on in his career. And in Sacramento, he changed that dynamic completely. Like, this guy coached them up on offense. And I think if the Knicks allow him to, they'll take my B grade to an A. But I don't know that Mike Brown has the sort of cultural within the game, within the league, amongst the players, cachet for him to come in and be like, yo, Brunson, you're going to get off the ball. You're going to trust that we're going to generate quality offense without you pounding the freaking air out of the rock. In crunch time, you're going to let other people do stuff and achieve stuff in crunch time, whether it's Bridges, whether it's Anunoby, or what I would like to see, Karl Towns. Like, I wonder if Mike Brown has the respect in order for him to go out and explain to these guys that they need to do it completely different than they did before. So that's why it's a B for me. Like, I heard Mike Brown and I was like, I think if Mike Brown is allowed to actually implement a new offense, I think he would implement something that you and I would recognize as like really cool and fun.
For sure.
I mean, however,
with those Kings teams, they are kind of the blueprint was, because you think about Sabonis, DHOs at the elbows.
I mean, come
Cat,
on.
Cat can do some of that stuff, but with a far better three-point shot, better off the dribble game. So, like, you pair that with Brunson, you get excited about the idea of Brunson and motion and movement and Bridges coming around a screen, getting into the mid-range. OG, instead of spotting up in the corners, like, the idea of these things, Josh Hart, and this is kind of this weird piece right in the middle of all of it. Like, the idea of this is very, very, very exciting. Yes, it is. And, like, I think the Knicks, hopefully Mitchell Robinson can have a healthy season, having two bigs, playing with Cat and Robinson, or just one big out there. Like, all of it is very, very exciting for what the Knicks could be. But to your point, will the roster embrace this? if that is indeed what Mike Brown would want to install with this personnel. Is Jalen Brunson willing to play that way after he has tasted great success being the ball dominant force that he is and that he's become? So I think if these guys, I think one of the reasons why I'd give this an A rather than a B right now is because I'm betting on honest conversations among those guys, the Nova Knicks here, with all those guys that seem to have a very close relationship. They host a freaking podcast together, like hopefully being able to have open conversations about what is best for us to take the next step. Maybe having an understanding of listening to Mike Brown, taking what you saw work for Indiana, taking what you saw work for all these teams that have had great success sharing the ball, having different guys with success. And the Knicks did have that stretch last year, Brunson out, Bridges, OG, Cat usage way up during that stretch, and the Knicks were playing pretty well. So I think as long as Mike Brown, to your point, is allowed to install elements of that Kings offense that was so great and so fun to watch, then yeah, like this could really work well, especially when considering, I mean, they added an upgrade over Campaign and Jordan Clarkson, and he's cheap. Yes. He's not making $15, $16 million anymore. He's on a league minimum. And then Gershon Yabusele, who's become a knockdown shooter, adds even more front court flexibility.
Excellent pickups, yes. KOC. So these, in terms of like the bang for the buck, the fit, the neat, like, excellent job by the Knicks front office. And the reason, and here's, and people will say like, oh, you said all these great things about Mike Brown. He's obviously a good coach. He's obviously super accomplished. Why are you so down on the hire? Because to me, if you're in a position that the Knicks are in where like you can taste the NBA finals, it's right there for you. You can literally smell the NBA finals. What they were supposed to do, were they were supposed to go take their market power, their financial might, and go blow Eric Spoelstra out the water. Say, yo, I'm going to guarantee you $150 million. Come be our coach. These motherfuckers will have no choice but to listen to what Coach Spoelstra got to say. Yo, Steve Kerr, Joe Lake could be playing with you sometimes over there. I know you love Steph Curry. I know you've won all these rings. Come embrace a new challenge. They got $150 million for you. You know, it, like, to be in this position, I would have liked to see the Knicks actually exercise some of the market power that they possess. There's no salary cap on coaches. Go blow out whoever it is that is at the top of the profession. Bring them to New York because you are on the precipice of the NBA Finals. And so to me, Mike Brown, like, I got a lot of love for Mike Brown, but, like, this is not a – it just doesn't feel like – an urgent enough hire to me. Where, like, I get it, your guys are relatively young, they're all in the contract, and you feel like, oh, we're going to have chances to get to the championship. I just think that's taking things for granted in a way that the Knicks shouldn't. And I think you're not OKC. You're not Indiana. You're not Memphis. You guys have money. you guys have an advantage that some of these small markets can't do around the edges in terms of personnel that aren't players. And I think the head coach, they should have went balls to the wall to get a guy at the top of the profession in there. And that's why I'm more down on the Mike Brown move than everybody else's.
All right, the Pistons, they made a head coaching change a year ago, getting JB Bickerstaff. They made a lot of changes this offseason. They lost Tim Hardaway, lost Dennis Schroeder, Malik Beasley. Well, I mean, you know, he's caught up in the whole gambling scandal right now. But they replaced those guys with Caris LeVert, Duncan Robinson. They also drafted Chaz Lanier as well, a guy who I had compared to Malik Beasley in my draft guide over at Yahoo Sports. So with Waz, like with what they did this offseason, how would you grade the Pistons reshuffling of the roster?
Again, a solid B, because I don't think their improvement is going to be based on offseason acquisitions. It's going to be on internal improvement, right? It's going to be about what Cade and the rest of the guys do. And Cade pretty much showed that he is obviously an all-star, legitimate level guy. He's going to be an all-NBA contention from now till kingdom come. Obviously, you and I are both Asar Thompson guys. I think the big question is, what happens with Jaden Ivey?
Yeah.
Like, does he take a step to become a fringe or knocking on the door, all-star level type of player? And how does he fit into the dynamic of, you know, Cade is like playing this like super heliocentric type of basketball. But I think for Detroit to be better, him and Ivy have to learn how to share space together. And I think that's going to be the defining question of next season for the Pistons, is what Jaden Ivey and Cade Cunningham can accomplish together. Ivey obviously got hurt, and Detroit still was able to soar. Their Knicks series was one of the most entertaining series in previous memory, obviously. So awesome. But I think Ivey is the sort of the breaking point here of where these guys can go. But like talent-wise, man, like, you know, Durin and Thompson and Ivy and Cunningham and even Toby as the solid vet. I want to see what Ron Holland does, who looked good in summer league. Again, it's summer league. I get it. And second year guys are supposed to dominate, but he did dominate. Sometimes we see second year guys look like bums. Ask the Lakers fans about that. Right. And so, you know, I just love the talent dispersal all up and down the roster. So like, for me, it's like Duncan Robinson. Beasley did help unlock something by being a guy that was just willing to fire 12 freaking threes per 36 or whatever the hell it was last year. And I think Duncan Robinson can achieve those same ends. And I think that now that they know the route to quality offense, they have that sort of internal knowledge collectively. They can incorporate Duncan Robinson with no problem. I'm not really worried about that. But to me, it's about the guys who are going to have the ball in their hands. How great they can be together. That's what it's all about to me.
I'd give the Pistons an A-. I think they did a good job replacing the guys that they lost. But I think you're spot on about
kind of. I think Schroeder's going to be missed, though.
Yeah, you know, unless Ivy can fill some of the ball handling.
Yes,
gap,
facts,
which gets to your point here. Like the big picture question with the Pistons isn't about them drafting Chaz Lanier or signing Caris LeVert. Like these, like, you know what you're going to get from those guys, and there's like a level of certainty with what you're going to get from those guys. The big question is Jaden Ivey gonna become the guy that they hoped that he would become when they drafted him? And if you look at last season, he was having the best season of his career until he got hurt, and he missed the entire rest of the season after he got hurt in January. But the numbers with him prior to the injury: Cade Cunningham on the floor versus off the floor. Jaden Ivey with Cade on the floor, as you'd expect, 18 points, 4 assists, 5 rebounds per 75 possessions. This is according to databaller.com. Without Cade, he was at 26.6 points per 75 possessions on a 57.6% true shooting. So super efficient, high volume scoring with Cade off the floor. And so if you think about Detroit, if he can be elite shooter, second banana behind Cade when they're sharing the floor together, but then be this guy who, like, as you said, is knocking on the door of being an all-star type of guy with Cade off the floor, then suddenly the Pistons are a team that no matter the lineup, no matter Cade on or off the floor, this team can be super, super hard to stop offensively. And so Ivy is the real key to that with their success moving forward. And I think to a lesser extent, guys like Ron Holland, I mean, he's only his second year. I think you want more defense from him before you're worried about the offense. Yes. Same thing with Ausar Thompson. You want more defense, and that's what you're getting from him already. Offense, hopefully it comes along, but you know you're getting tough, gritty defense. And I think, you know, like you think about like these young teams in the NBA nowadays, like a lot of them, they have defense. Like they have solid defensive players.
Pistons got that.
Exactly. And I think with what was that you said?
I said the Pistons got that.
Yeah, they got that. They got the toughness. They absolutely have that. And Orlando has that too. Well, Orlando, the big concern with them has been shooting. They were 30th in the NBA in three-point percentage, 22nd in the NBA in three-point attempts. And then they go and add Desmond Bane, giving up a ton of first-round picks. They sign Tyus Jones, a point guard. They draft Jace Richardson, another guard out of Michigan State. They lose KCP, they lose Cole Anthony, they lose Gary Harris. Give me a grade, Waz, for the Magic shakeup this offseason.
To me, the Magic are A for me. The Desmond Bane move, I know a lot of people are like, oh, how do you give up all of that for Desmond Bane? It's like, context matters, guys. The fact that they believe in their two wings, Franz and Paolo, and they've run into the exact same predictable-ass problem for two postseasons in a row where nobody can make a freaking shot. To go out and get an upgrade like Desmond Bane, who, you know, in the last 2 years has shown that there's more to his game than just spot up shooting, you know, or taking open jump shots. Like, this guy is a dynamic scorer. And if Jalen Suggs can actually stay on the ground, that four man right there, KOC, I'm putting against anybody in the East. I'm talking about including Cleveland, okay, including the Knicks. If those four guys can stay healthy, they're going to be tough to beat. And Bane is such that, like, when you're committing all of these resources to stopping Paolo and Wagner in the paint, like, this guy, you can't leave this dude alone. And his dribble driving off of, you know, scrambling defenses and rotations, like driving against rotations. Like, this guy is really good against set defenses. You put him against a rotating defense, like, now the Magic have an offense that's like, oh, this is like getting to be kind of scary and can be dangerous and even dominant at times. And so for me, I think Desmond Bane, like, this was a guy that was carrying offense for Memphis throughout many portions of the last two seasons because of Ja Morant, his myriad of issues of not being able to stay on the court. And you now ask him to do the most highly optimized versions of that in Orlando. I think, like, it's just a no-brainer to me. To me, it's about Jalen Suggs, man, really staying on the court, because I think the jump shot finally started to fall last season. It finally started to feel like something that was pretty close to reliable. Which, you know, clearly took his game to another level. I don't know if you were watching a lot of Magic early last season, man. Like, Jalen Suggs was a freaking beast. And I think most importantly, more importantly than the sort of tangible stuff that he does on the court, I think Suggs is the mindset and the temperament setter for the team. He is the most maniacally competitive person. Like, he's one of the most insanely, like, Kevin Garnett, like, almost almost toxic level competitive kind of guys in the NBA. And I think that element is so important for the Magic. And so Suggs, to me, the combination of adding Baines and having Suggs actually stay on the court, I'm super bullish on what the Magic could do next year.
Me too, Waz. I mean, I think when you look at last season in the NBA, there were 21 guys that took over 8 three-point attempts per game. Desmond Bane was not one of them, but he is one of the best shooters in all of basketball. I think you're going to see his usage go up from three-point range in Orlando. Yes. You're going to see him involved in two-man actions with Franz Wagner and with Paolo Banchero and even with Wendell Carter. You're going to see Desmond Bane heavily involved in this offense. And I think your point about, you know, with Franz and Paolo, like, you want to see those guys shoot well. Like, it's important for them, especially Franz Wagner, to become a competent shooter. Banchero, we've seen more flashes than we have with Wagner in recent years. But those guys still get to the rim at will, despite a lack of spacing, despite the fact that they have shooting inconsistencies outside. They still get to the rim at will. And so if you're adding more spacing to the equation there, with Desmond Bane being the key piece among the other guys that you added this offseason, like, suddenly they could get even better, leading to kickout opportunities, leading to Desmond Bane attacking against a rotating off-balance defense. And Bane can do a lot off the dribble as well, in addition to becoming a knockdown shooter off the catch. And so I think with the Magic, they are indeed a real threat in the East. But so much of it is going to come down to, as you said, the health of Jalen Suggs and the continued development of Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner. And we really won't know how that's going to go until the regular season. But I'm optimistic about what they've done.
And another thing to remember about last season, like, again, I'm somebody, I don't know that there's ever been a bigger Kentavious Caldwell-Pope booster.
Oh, he stunk last year.
He just could not make a shot.
Crazy.
And, like, and just to piggyback off that, even if KCP was playing at his best last year, like, what Desmond Bane is bringing to the table is an order of magnitude.
Way more.
It's just another level in terms of the difference this guy can make for them. So, like, even your most optimistic KCP projections don't even meet the basement of what we can expect from Desmond Bane next season. And so that's what I think is really important about the Magic outlook and projecting what they could do in the future going forward.
We'll be right back. Move on to the Western Conference here. Was Jonathan Kuminga has been in the news a lot as of late. It's been a lot of Jonathan Kuminga talk, more than I anticipated this entire offseason. Latest news was from Anthony Slater over at ESPN, and he said, the word I've heard used from the Kuminga side is pawn. He doesn't want to sign this two-year, $45 million deal with a team option when he clearly would just be used as a trade midseason. Mm-hmm. That's not something he wants to sign up for. And so the idea is here that he could potentially accept the $8 million qualifying offer, which would mean he has a no-trade clause for this season, and he'd be an unrestricted free agent a year from now. Give me a grade for Jonathan Kuminga's approach this entire offseason.
I mean, I give him a B+. They're trying to play ultra hardball with the guy. Like the Warriors are trying to be tough negotiators. And I think like that's kind of been their history. Like they kind of do they did it with Klay Thompson. They did it with Steph.
They did it with Curry. The legends. They did it with the dynasty. They did it with Draymond. They did it with everybody.
Like Iguodala. Like they've done this to everyone. So I don't think we should be surprised that they're doing it to Jonathan Kuminga. I just think the deal that they offered is a deal. Like this idea that you're offering me only a two-year deal and then it's a team option on the second year? Like what would be – so I'm being held hostage by you as pure trade bait on the second – like what is the – why would Kuminga not just be like, all right, you're offering me 15% more in guaranteed money, but I get my freedom at the end of it and you can't trade me if I do my qualifying offer? Like they need to like get off of there like – oh, we're the masters of, you know, we're freaking art of the deal Donald Trump here. And we're just master negotiators. They need to get out of here with that and just give the guy a fair deal or just move him. Like, get off the pod again. I think Kuminga is playing this the way he's supposed to. They offered him a crap deal. And it's like, I'd rather just bet on myself and become unrestricted next year.
Let's flip that.
One
then,
more
Wallace.
Year moping around here won't bother me.
Well, let's flip this then, because I'm 100% with you on the Kuminga side of things here. Like, why would you want to go to a place that they don't want you and you don't want them? So both sides don't want each other. You know that they would want to use you as a trade piece midseason. So with the Warrior side of things, though, it's understandable why they would want to keep Kuminga, because there's not a deal right now, but there could be a deal in January or February. So that's why they would want to retain the asset. And who knows? Maybe this is his, you know, breakout year and you decide to keep him on a discount deal. So you retain that possibility, too. But from the Warrior side of things, you have Stephen Curry, you know, talking about all he plays for is a championship right now. The beginning of last season was a disaster. Draymond and Steph aren't giving their all until they get Jimmy Butler. They close the year great. Of course, they flame out in the playoffs. But the Warriors, I feel like it's contradictory here. On one hand, are you actually going all in or not in this situation? Because it took you a while to go get Jimmy Butler. You didn't give up a lot to get him. Butler has his flaws at this stage of his career, for that matter, too. And so then you are playing this game with Jonathan Kuminga, a guy you don't actually want and you don't actually think fits on your team during an offseason in which you have done literally nothing at all. Like, are the Warriors actually trying to do everything to win a championship right now? Because I don't see it that way. I don't think they are.
Yeah, it just makes no sense to pretend that Kuminga leaving next offseason for absolutely nothing wouldn't be a complete disaster.
Oh, big time.
So to me, it's just up the offer, you know, make it 2 years guaranteed, give him his player option on the third, basically something similar to what Jalen Green got in Houston. You know, he ended up, I think, getting $33 million a year. All right, give Kuminga $27 million per year. Player option, and let's keep it pushing. Because, like, we're not going to pretend that this guy is valueless, right? And there's clearly other suitors that are willing to pay him close to that you know, higher number. I don't think the 34 or 33 that Jalen Green got. And he's been less productive than Jalen Green, to be fair. But I think a deal in that range where it's like we acknowledge that you have potential to be better, but we also acknowledge that you haven't been as good as you think you are. So let's do a deal that acknowledges both truths, right? And I think a two plus one, you know, under 30 mil, where the guy feels like, all right, I get to be unrestricted in 2 years while also getting a significant pay bump that isn't breaking the bank. You know, I think that's kind of the direction they should try to go. I think Jalen Green is kind of the model here.
The Nuggets replaced Michael Porter Jr. and Russell Westbrook.
A plus plus.
Cam Johnson.
And this is before I saw the podcast with Steiny, by the way. This is A plus plus, Kev. You don't got to finish it. I've been trading Michael Porter Jr. from the Nuggets for 3-4 years now, bro. He is a one-dimensional, single-note, sometimes-he-ass player, okay? Also, with one of the craziest back situations, and he deserves credit for playing as much games, being as durable as he's been, but the medical is the medical. And then you just think about, like, he's just such a not hot. Let's just say he's not the most cerebral hooper. I'm not going to get into how smart he is off the court. We don't know. I'll let you guys decide. You can watch the interviews with the porn stars and the Nelk boys and decide for yourself how intelligent this guy is. But like the idea that you would get him out of here for Cam Johnson, who makes half the money and is just a better player. He's just better.
Way better.
He's just better. He just knows how to move off the ball, cuts off the ball. Look, I remember we used to call him 3 and D. We know he's not a D. But he's going to try. He's going to give it his all. He might not be very effective.
He's more than 3 on offense now than he was in Phoenix. He's developed more and more tools offensively. 100%.
And just the way this guy has a mind for the game, his temperament, it's just the perfect Jokic teammate. Then now, Jokic can now play 36 minutes legitimately per game in the regular season because that backup five position has been solidified. Okay? Like
best backup five of Jokic's entire career.
And it's not even close. Yeah. And I'm saying even when Nurkic was his backup five, okay? Okay? And so
Nurkic was never any good, so.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, to bring Bruce Brown back on a vet man, I mean, like, A plus plus offseason for Denver, but I do think, and my guy Adam Mares put this beautifully, like the Valanciunas thing is so key in allowing Jokic to save himself for the playoffs when he is going to need to play 43 minutes a game. To not have to do that in the regular season because we're jerking around with Zeke Nagy at the five, or God bless him, you know, DeAndre. I mean, like, this is just going to make a world of difference.
Mm-hmm. And not to mention, they had Tim Hardaway Jr. and Bruce Brown. So they solidified the wing spot as well with old friend Bruce Brown, former champion. He's going to be back with Jokic. Like, maybe Bruce Brown returns to the guy we saw in Denver. So I think they're on paper, they've closed the gap with OKC. The question is, has OKC, has their young guys, will they take another step to widen the gap again? You're not?
But I'm the biggest OKC skeptic in the media, probably. All right,
let's move to OKC then. Give me a grade for OKC's decision to do nothing besides re-sign their own guys.
No, they get an A. I mean, like, what are you really supposed to be doing? I think we overrate. Like, we think that these guys get frozen in time as people. As we acknowledge that they evolve as players, but we don't acknowledge that in time as people.
Are you talking about the college fun vibes after games and stuff like that?
Yeah, it's cute now.
Yeah.
It's cute now. Living in OKC and eating that Cracker Barrel every other day with your family is cute now. But there's going to come a time. I'm talking about even the guys that have wives, okay?
SGA
these
has
people,
a wife,
they're
right?
Rich yeah. people. There's going to come a time where they've outgrown the lifestyle of OKC. The idea that it's just us and our basketball and cocoon and all that matters is hoop and we're so dedicated and blah, blah, blah. Like, that shit is cool now. They're young and impressionable. I don't think that's going to be the case forever. I'm not saying next year is when you know, we're going to start seeing the cracks where, you know, J-Dub is like, I'm tired of being a pip. I want to be Gladys Knight. I'm not saying it's going to happen next year. I'm just saying I'm not completely bought in to the kumbaya atmosphere of OKC. Right. I think these guys are going to develop as people. And I don't know that guys are always going to be happy living in Oklahoma City, being second fiddle to Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and that being the pinnacle of what life could be for them. I'm not convinced of that. And maybe I'm crazy. Maybe I'm just projecting stuff that isn't there. I'm just like, guys, like, no disrespect to the prairie. No disrespect to the heartland. I got love for real America. I got love for the meat and potatoes, down home Americans. I'm not being a city slicker. I'm just telling you that I'm just telling you that young, rich, black dudes, some of them might freaking get tired of it. That's just something I'm putting out there. You know, whatever. I haven't reported this. I'm not on close friends basis with any of these guys. I'm just talking about human nature here.
You don't get the green circle with J-Dub and SGA on Instagram? They didn't put you on the close friends?
No, I'm not on the close friends. How about Chet? Not yet. But Chet is still my guy. Okay, shout out to him full court. Fitzalum. I think they played the offseason perfectly fine. They're all still hanging out together.
They're going to Caruso's wedding.
Be fine.
Chet
and they got
in that
young
white suit and all that. They're having
that
a good time.
That was a bad suit. He need a new stylist. But they got young guys like Topic and all of these guys that they still running off the assembly line. Like, I think they're gonna be fine. I'm just telling you. Like, I saw Tim Hardaway Jr. in Vegas. I might have had a few Hugo Spritzes, KOC, and I walked up to him and said, "Yo, y'all gonna win the chip next year?" So just remember, you heard it here first, okay? OKC is not going to be the first repeat team since Golden State. I think they're going to go down next year.
For OKC fans listening, Waz mentions Cracker Barrel as the as the restaurant OKC. I've been recommended the restaurant Packards in OKC. I've heard Packards is really good. Leave a comment.
What's another one?
That's the only one I've ever been recommended.
What else they got over there? What other restaurants?
Yeah, leave a comment recommending OKC.
Do they have a Nobu out there?
I don't know if I'd want the Nobu sushi in Oklahoma.
Okay.
Don't know if I want.
Interesting.
Non-fresh sushi.
Do they
sushi.
Have a Carbone out there? Interesting. Okay. I'm just asking questions, man. Do they have a Delilah out there?
Unbelievable.
Listen, I'm just asking the questions.
LA,
do they
New
got
York.
A pergola out there? I'm just asking the questions, guys. I'm not saying like that guys should want to leave. I'm just saying what I've known about NBA players and what they care about. It seems like OKC doesn't offer a lot of those things. And I'm talking about even for the guys that are married, have kids and all of that stuff. You know, it's a great city for the average American. Yes, the average American would love to raise their family in a city that possesses the qualities of Oklahoma City. I agree. But we're not talking about average Americans here when you're talking about NBA players. That's all. I'm just pointing that out.
But at the same time, that might be true. But if this team continues to win 60-plus games and they have a good group of guys, and you feel
if you feel like you have a chance to be a dynasty,
if you feel like you have a chance to be part of something bigger than you, why would you not want to invest in that and be part of that?
It's KOC, stop it. That sounds good to you and I on the outside looking in. That's not how these dudes are wired.
But some operate that way. Not everybody. Not everybody just wants the bright lights.
At a certain point, the winning starts to have diminishing returns. Because it's like, I've been there and done that. Like, I want to conquer something new. And the only way to achieve that is to do it somewhere else or to do it in a different capacity, right? Like, that becomes the new challenge. Like, yeah, I can be a role player on six straight 65-win teams, but that just means you've done it six straight times, right? It's not the same as a guy who was on a team 30 wins every single year. That 65-win season becomes more, it feels better. Sure. Like, there's just no two ways about it. It's like when you ask, you know, when you ask Derek Jeter somebody, oh, which championship matters? Which one do you cherish most, the first one or the fourth one? He's going to be like, it's the first one. right? Like, they start to have diminishing returns the more that you do it. I'm not saying these guys aren't going to want to win. These are the most competitive people that our species produces. These guys want to win. But just winning in a vacuum is not always the only thing. There's different things that soothe these people's egos, KOC. And it can't always be placated by being the fourth best guy in Oklahoma. I'm sorry. There are different challenges out there, guys. I'm just acknowledging that truth. I'm not breaking up the team next year. I'm just saying, everybody projecting 10 straight years of 60-plus wins for OKC. I'm like, you guys don't think about the human condition, like, at all, do you? I just find that to be baffling.
Here's the thing, Waz. I bet you Sam Presti is thinking about the things that you're talking about, because his choice multiple years in a row now to keep the picks. He could have traded three picks and gotten a center a year ago. He could have traded multiple picks to go get Lauri Markkanen and package guys together. He could have done literally anything he wanted with the picks. And instead, he kept the picks. And this year, he drafts Thomas Sorber in the first round, because he knows at some point Isaiah Hartenstein is probably going to become too expensive or is going to walk. He knows these guys. He drafts Topic because maybe at some point Jalen Williams wants to go somewhere else and he's going to need another ball handler. I think Presti is keeping the picks because he knows that he's going to have to turn things over. A, 100%. Because the financial aspect of the NBA with the CBA, you're naturally going to have roster turnover quicker and more often than ever before because of the CBA. And B, because of the human element that you're talking about, where there's going to be a guy that decides they want to go. It's going to happen. Teams always are changing. It happens in every sport, in every league. And with OKC, it's inevitable that somebody's going to leave or want to leave at some point. It's just a matter of when.
By the way, I can already hear like OKC fans being like, these fucking idiots are trading our guys already and
nobody's
we just won our
that.
First one.
Nobody's doing
I'm
that.
Not doing that. I'm just saying the way the media generally portrays it as if these guys are going to rattle off.
Who does that?
Everybody, bro. Kev, everybody. It's like, okay, all of these picks, the picks are to replenish the guys that are eventually going to leave. That's why they're keeping the picks.
Yes.
It's like, we're going to have to replace the Hartensteins. We're going to have to replace the Carusos. Like, eventually, some of these other guys who want cheap deals are going to demand way more money. They're going to get poached by other teams. Like, all of that stuff. Like, and I'm acknowledging it. And I want to say, too, Sam Presti, I was a bit of a Presti skeptic and hater. The minute he re-signed, got Paul George to re-sign in the Prairie, after that man told people for 5 years that he wanted to be in Los Angeles, he got him to re-sign. I was like, yo, this guy is the best at his job. There's nobody better at connecting on a human level, seeing the bigger vision. Like, there are people that, like, understand how the cap works and how you gotta, you know, allocate talent and blah, 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 blah. But, like, him being able to connect with the dudes on a human level while also sort of understanding the holistic elements of putting a roster together, I think is brilliant. He's one of the best. And also, don't get it twisted. He had Kevin Durant eating out the palm of his hands in them early OKC years. But if you ask KD, would you ever go back to Oklahoma? No, I'm not doing that no more. I'm too big. I'm too global. I'm too much for OKC. And I think that will always be a limiting factor for OKC. That's all. That's all I'm acknowledging. And I don't think they're going to win the championship next year.
I can't.
Just throwing that in there, too.
What's your prediction to represent the West right now? Is it Houston?
Oh, Denver.
KD? Is
Denver.
It Denver? What do
Denver.
You Denver. Okay.
Denver. Denver is just the improvements that they made. Like, we got to understand, like, these are the guys that gave OKC. I mean, until the Pacers, honestly. Again, like, we're pretending OKC is like this. They were about to lose game 7 to the Pacers, okay? Like, why are we pretending that this is like the Kevin Durant Warriors we're watching here? It's not. They're probably the league's best team and most talented. They're great. They're going to be right there. They have as good a chance, if not better, than every other team in the NBA to win the chip. They're entrenched in contender category. But that doesn't mean that they are just a cut above everybody else. I don't personally believe that. And so to me, I think Denver has improved on the margins, and even the series that they lost, you just got to think if like they didn't have to play like Pickett and Strother and DJ, and like it, you just got to believe if they didn't have to do these things on the margins, they would have won that series. You know what I mean? And so to me, they've made the necessary improvements, and the championship pedigree is there. Jokic, to me, is still on a level of his own as the best player in basketball right now. Give me Denver for the championship, KOC.
Over who? Knicks? Nuggets over man, Knicks? Is that what you got? Nuggets over Magic? Man.
I still like Cleveland. I know that they imploded last year, but I just think that they're on such a solid footing in terms of the trajectory, in terms of that thing that we talked about with the Knicks.
You're not picking the Knicks, Waz. No, I'm not.
I got to see it on the floor. I got to be convinced that they're actually going to do things differently than they did last year. I want to see it. I know Cleveland has the capacity, like they've already shown a capacity to improve upon this certain style of ball that they did. And I think they've just shown that they have evolution within them. And I think they're going to evolve into an even better, more dynamic team. And I think Evan Mobley, he's got to have seen the light. Like, yo, this team is going to go as far as I take them. And if I turn it to what my potential demands, I think to me, it's Cleveland.
I like it. I'll make my final predictions after preseason, obviously. But I think right now I lean Cleveland for all the reasons that you're saying, projecting them to get better. And I also really trust Kenny Atkinson as a coach and him installing some of those improvements. And boy, like Denver's changes, man. I think it's going to be them and OKC in the West Finals as of today. And I don't expect that prediction to
change. I look forward to that part two, by the way.
Yeah, me too. I hope to God we get that part two. And we get four games with them in the second half of the season. So those could be some pretty big games too. But I'll give the credit to the defending champions right now and lean towards OKC as of now in the middle of August. A lot can change. Waz, thanks for joining me today, man. How's your summer going? Yeah, I mean, you got any plans for the summer?
Man, I just came back from 2 weeks in Spain last week. That was a great time. We went to Barcelona, went to Mallorca, went to Ibiza. It was just incredible. Spain is just a magical place. Just spent a lot of time in New York, honestly, the rest of the time this summer. So, yeah, just enjoying it, man. Can't complain.
Hope you enjoy the rest of your summer, Waz. Always good talking
Appreciate
to you, man.
You too, bro. Yeah. Also, man, you got it. Have you become a guitar collector since you left L.A.?
I've played guitar since 2007. I've played guitar, so almost 20 years now I've been playing guitar. But this year, I had a few years where I wasn't playing as often. This year, I'm getting back in the rhythm, playing more often, making it something I do on a daily basis, getting my calluses back on my fingers. And I'm gonna do some guitar covers, post those on social in the weeks.
All right, I'm ready for the John Mayer content, man. I'm here for it, bro.
Right now,
I want to see it.
Hotel California, I'm working on right now. So I got the album over my shoulder.
Hey, man, send me them links. I need it ASAP.
We'll do, Waz. Appreciate you joining me today, man. Thank you.
Of course, man. Much love, my boy.
Thanks again to Waz for joining me. Thanks to Emmy and Dakota for producing it. Thanks to Father John Misty for the music. We'll be back again later in the week with more podcasts. Have a good day. See you.